My name's Neil. I'm an addict. Real quick, I usually don't cry right off the bat. Pretty much all of us come in here with baggage, stuff we did, things we were, situations that happened around us. Some of us despicable. I mean, and it's based on how we feel. Some of us bad. We come in here dragging stuff. And we all deserve the chance to get clean. That's why you introduced me. Because he's despicable. Oh, shit, this is starting off now. All right, like I said, my name's Neil. I'm an addict. My clean date was January 10th, 1985. And yes, I said was, and we'll get to that. But we're here on a Sunday morning. I'm really grateful for that. So if you could open your hymnals to page... before I get too far in, I want to say thank you to Shaney, Tim on the soundboard. Like Susan said last night, there's usually 10%, and it's not just NA. It's all organizations. Usually about 10% of the people do 85 to 90% of the work. And... before I even get, I'm getting ahead of myself. But if you're new, a really tremendous way to really get involved, to break through a barrier, is to take on service. Back in the day, it was clean ashtrays. We don't have ashtrays anymore. But I can remember when I was first coming around, in the Tidewater area, there was only 7 meetings. And... I remember I was going to, and for me, I ended up going to some meetings in that other fellowship, which I'm not ashamed of. They are our forebears. And I remember I was at a meeting, and it was a meet with old-timers, 40 and 50 years in that fellowship. And an old-timer turned to me. I was a sniveling-ass, junky, drunk, snot-nosed little shit. And an old-timer turned to me and gave me the key to the church. And said, you're opening next week. Kept my ass clean. And it made me feel part of. And now, in last night when they did the countdown, and they said, anybody 35 years or more, and a bunch of people stood up. When I, Jeff and myself, Teddy, when we got here, there wasn't anybody in the state of Virginia with more than 6 or 7 years. Bob S. had like 4. Judith might have had, 5 or 6. In 84, 85. And so part of the deal was there wasn't a whole, in the Tidewater area, 3-4 years was an old timer. And everybody was in their mid 20s to early 30s. So there was no life experience and very little recovery experience. People hadn't lived through death of family members, divorces, bankruptcies. We're all brand freaking new and crazy as shit. If you're getting clean now, Narcotics Anonymous has grown. We have matured. There are people here with decades of life experience clean. And that is a tremendous gift, asset, whatever. So, I got introduced to Narcotics Anonymous in 1984, February of 84. And is this ringing really bad? It can rise to the point of freedom. All right, that's wrong. Oh, let's try that. Thank you very much. And I got the person who was, God, what are you doing? The person who I first met in NA was, a lot of y'all might know, Bob S. And I just didn't relate to him. He was in the Navy, which that's not a bad thing. And, you know, his drug use was different than mine. And I just didn't connect. I'm thinking, okay, this NA thing must be okay for people like that. And but then I went to my first meeting. There was a meeting. I was in a, you know, treatment center, and it was a meeting on Sunday night. I think it was Sunday night. It might have been Monday or Tuesday. I have no fucking idea. And for 38 years, I thought it was Sunday night, but I might be wrong. And the person chairing the meeting, Mike B., I listened to him talk, and the people sitting around the rooms, and I was like, son of a bitch, these people have been to places I've been. And I'd like to say I got clean right then, but I didn't. I had to do more research. I couldn't figure out that step one. That's the thing. I kept trying to figure it out, trying to analyze it, trying to, okay, what does it mean? And January 10th, let me back up. There was a bunch of us that came in. Jeff B. came in about the same time, and Jeff called me up and said, you're going to the convention. I was at work. I was like, well, I'll be there in an hour. Okay. Fortunately, I worked for a family business, and I had already told my dad and my uncle, so look, I'm going to probably steal just as much time from the business trying to get clean as I did when I was using, and I stole a lot of time using. And so I said, I'm going to this convention thing. When I got here, I was in the middle of a divorce, and it hurt horrible bad. I never knew a man or woman. I never knew a person could hurt that inside. I mean, my guts felt like an ice-cold dish rag that somebody was squeezing all the moisture out of. And part of the reason why it hurt so bad was I started using when I was 13. And so I never dealt with pain. And so I come in here, and I lose my best friend, the using, the drugs, and then my validation, I must be okay. Look at this beautiful woman that's on my arm. Lost that too. And so Jeff, he came and got me, and I was in all this terrible pain. And before he got me, I packed a little suitcase, whatever, and I got on my knees. Well, one thing y'all taught me to do was pray, and I'll get to that. I got kind of ahead of myself here. And I said, God, if you could give me any kind of, now, wait, let me stop right there. I did not have this great theology and, you know, all this kind of, the word God is just a simple word to say that means some sort of spiritual help. I said, God, if you could give me something to help me get through this weekend, I'd really appreciate it. This hurts bad. Because Bruce Springsteen was playing at Hampton Coliseum that weekend, and I knew my estranged was going to that show with her boyfriend. And they've now been married 30-some years, and he's a great guy. But anyway, they were going to that, and I knew they'd be making love in the middle of the concert, and it was just, you know, I visualize all this. You know, I don't know about y'all, but I have a tendency to torture myself. And so I said, God, if you could give me something to help me with this, I'd really appreciate it. So we got to the convention. It was the third ABCNA. Got there, went into the hotel. It was at the downtown Marriott. It was fancy. I thought it was a fancy hotel, like marble and shit in the lobby, and a, I don't know, maybe a fountain or something. And there was a restaurant over in one corner of the lobby with like a little terrace out in front. This is inside, out in front of a, you know, a little fenced in area and tables. And there's, you know, bikers hugging people in suits and all this kind of crap. I'm like, holy shit, what the hell is this? And all of a sudden, I realized that there was a lady over there on that terrace playing a harp, you know, like angels play. She was playing the Beatles, Eleanor Rigby, on a harp, wearing a long black, like, evening dress. Do you remember that? I was like, holy shit, what have I walked into? And so I went upstairs, and this part's a little bit humorous, except my wife doesn't like it. Somebody was letting me stay with John M. was letting me share a room with him. And went up, put my shit up there, and came back down to the lobby. And this tall, statuesque blonde walked up to me and said, I'd like to make love to you. And I said, damn, this works. This God stuff is powerful. And but that was funny. But, well, it was humorous. It was more than funny. But anyway, my story is full of poignant memories that were powerful. It was a Saturday night. They still did banquets. It was time for the banquet. And I was standing out in the hallway where people filed into the banquet hall. I had 3 days clean. And people said, everybody just talking. Well, Dio, you going to the banquet? No, I don't have a ticket. I'm going to go across the street, get some pizza or something. I was okay. I'm going to go get some pizza. I'm fine with that. I cry because, like most of y'all, I've almost died more than once, and my spirit was dead. So I'm standing out there, and I'm saying, and the guy taking the tickets, I don't remember who it was, turned to me and said, how much clean time you got? And I said, 3 days. He said, you're going in Sarah. That's how this shit works. We all deserve a chance to get clean. So let me back up. The first time I was influenced by any kind of substance, it was alcohol. I was 13 years old. Let me back up a little bit further. I'm talking about poignant memories. My first day of first, and our, if you read the Just for Today, it talks on this today. And that's a suggestion also. If you haven't read Just for Today, you need to start making that a habit. But anyway, I'm not your sponsor. I probably should be, but I remember stepping into the door frame of my first day of first grade, looking into the room and thinking, I'm not like any of these kids. I was six. And I grew up in a very loving and caring home. I grew up in a church that preached about a loving and caring God and all this kind of, as Baptist, but still somehow it did loving and caring. And so I've always grown up with love. And I walked in that classroom. I'm not like any of these kids in here. I am the misfit. They all know each other. They all know how to dress. They all know how to interact. And that stuck with me all through. Although as I got into school, I had lots of friends. I was accepted in all the cliques and everything. And I would still feel like I didn't fit in. So at 13 years old, I grew up on a farm, not with cows and chickens, just a big piece of land with fields and stuff. And so as we got older and we became dangerous kids, if we wanted to stay out all night, we could camp out. Oh, we're going to camp out. And a buddy of mine had a bottle of a lot of y'all know Tracy and Dee Dee. He was Dee Dee's brother. And had a bottle of bourbon. And it was a high school band. We're camping out, so we went up to the high school basketball game, smuggled a bottle of bourbon into the boys' restroom. So this time I'm like 13 years old, getting into all the adolescent insecurities. And we'd go in and take a little sip, We went in one time, and Paul, chug-a-lo, I love chug-a-lo. Then he handed it to me, and it was a little bit in, and I tipped it up, and somebody said, it's the cops. Now, I had nothing to do with illegal activities, but I knew I had to get rid of the evidence. So I just chug-a-lo it down, and stumbled back to the wall, and slid down, and slumped at the bottom of the wall. A wave of nausea came over me. I held the nausea. I didn't get sick. And when that nausea passed, I was drunk. I'd never been drunk before, but I knew I was drunk, especially when I tried to stand back up. The poignant aspect of that was the freedom. All of those insecurities were gone. And it was like, this is what it's supposed to feel like. This is how it's supposed to be. And so the next several years, next 13 years or so, I pursued that. And I never recaptured that sense of peace. All through high school and all, it was fun, it was adventure, new drugs, different things, and then I got married, and then I'm using when I do not want to use. I have gone to cop with tears running down my face. I wanted to not go so bad. I'm lying, because I'm stealing so much time from work and everything, and lying to everybody about where I've been. Real quick, a lot of y'all might remember that Denzel Washington movie about where he flew the plane up. He was an alcoholic and flew the plane upside down. And towards the end, he's in prison, and he's talking about, well, you could have just, somebody's asking him, I guess it's like a 12-step meeting in the prison. Well, you could have just thrown that stewardess under the bus. You know, you could have said she drank it, and you would have saved your career. And he said, I just couldn't lie anymore. And that's what happened in February of 84. I came home late again. My wife was all upset. I just couldn't lie anymore. I got to where I couldn't tell where the lies started and stopped, what was true, what wasn't true, if I'm getting ready, what I'm getting ready to tell, if this going to jibe with what I said the night before. And I told her, and that's how I ended up in treatment. And so, moving forward and past the third ABCNA, it was January 10th, and I had 10 days clean, and it was snowing. And we ran my family business. We ran a record service, and I was driving one of the tow trucks. And the dope man came around the corner, and we lived in those country roads back then. And neither one of us could stop right away. I saw him put his brakes on. Of course, I put my brakes on, and we're backing up towards each other. And I don't know if y'all are familiar with the battle. No, don't do it, don't do it. Oh, it's only 10 days. No, don't. Well, we've already started. This will be the last time. We'll pick a white chip. This is back when you had chips. And I got a little something, and I went back to the, I cooked it up in a cooker full of snow. And I did what I had to do, and I probably could have chopped my arm off and not felt it, but it didn't do anything in here. It just didn't work. And I call it a moment of grace. I finally understood step one. We hear people sharing the meetings all the time. I had a hard time understanding about being an addict. You know, I had a hard time accepting that I was an addict. That's not what the step says. The step says we admitted we were powerless over our addiction and that our lives had become unmanageable. And I finally understood that. Step one tells me, Neil, I don't care how much you want to not use. You cannot not use. There was an old junkie back home at the time, much older than me, 20 years or so older than me, and I said, you're going to end up just like that guy. Step one was a place of utter despair. I said, Neil, you've been trying to not use for the last 5 or 6 years. You cannot not use. You're doomed to destroy everything you care about, and your life is a train wreck. But the most important message I heard when I first got here, and it's still our most important message, I think, is when we tell a newcomer, just keep coming. Most important thing you can do, just keep coming. So I'd been coming, and I'd heard the steps, and I knew there was a step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, I said, I believe the people in these rooms can show me how not to use today. That's all. Just show me how not to use today. If I can just get through today. In step three, we made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Did I say that right? The only thing I needed to understand about God or a higher power at that time, the only thing I really could understand is y'all were clean, I was not. Y'all were doing something that I wasn't doing. And the only way y'all could help me is if my wife hates it when I say this. If I finally, I told myself, Neil, turn off the psychobabble bullshit. And for once in your life, just do what you're told. And I did. I came in here and I started, you know, what do I do? What do I do? And now that sounds like I was, you know, I'd be a robot and I would just do what. When I made that decision, just show me what to do. It wasn't a great philosophical, theological decision. It was just, please show me what to do so I don't have to use today. I found some of that freedom that I thought I was going to capture when I was using. I found it here. And so I started everything. I couldn't. The only thing in my life that's ever tried to kill me is right in here. I can't trust, to 23 years clean now, I can't trust this son of a bitch. If any of y'all are listening to MP3, I'm pointing to my head, where my brain is, well, at least used to be. And And so I just started the simplest little thing. I had only half jokingly say I would, you know, be getting ready to go to work in the morning. I'd call my sponsor, "Don't get ready to go to work. Don't wear blue socks or white socks." Because I did not know which thought was going to pop into my head and get me back on that track. And y'all told me to, the stuff y'all told me to do. And I started doing it. You told me to, when I get up in the morning, ask for the strength to live clean that day. You did not tell me, once you develop a good theology and you have a tremendous relationship with a loving, caring God, you said, "We don't care if you're talking to the fucking wind. Just get on your knees, because that's an act of humility. This is a program based on humility. Ask for the strength to live clean that day." And so I started doing that, and I got a day clean. They said at the end of the day, if you've made it through the day clean, get on your knees. Thank your higher power for a day clean. Been doing that for a long time now. Now, I told you I was in a lot of that pain, a lot of just tremendous emotional pain with this divorce, never dealt with pain. I added something to it, and it was sometime later I understood what I was doing. I would, at the end of the day, I said, "Well, thank you, God, for another day clean, and thank you for one less day of pain." Now, I didn't know when the pain was going to end from the divorce and all, but I knew I was one day closer. Because I hadn't used. So that day was done. And what I realized sometime later, or somebody told me, said, "Yeah, what you're doing is you're closing your day off with an attitude of gratitude." It wasn't, I mean, it might have been a bitch of a day, but I made it through it clean. Like I just said, I've got 23 years this time, been around for 38 years. And I'll still be walking through the day, going to my truck to go to work, and I'll just stop and like, "Holy crap, I'm clean. I can do anything I want to do today." The wonder has not stopped, has not ceased. So I worked through the steps, worked through the process. The first three came as a package. Life got better. I started feeling better about myself. I got in these habits. I'm a big one to believe that you can do. You need to start applying some of the principles of the other steps before you even get to them with a sponsor. And like step 10 is a simple one. If you're at work and you just, you know, blast the crap out of somebody, you can go back and make an amends. You can say, "I'm sorry," and I'll try to. But one I did, it was real big for me. I was taught, well, they try to teach me, do something good for yourself. At least once a week, do something good for yourself. So I got this little pattern going where on Sunday afternoons I make myself a little thermos of coffee. I love being outdoors. That's why I come to Brandon. And I make myself a little thermos of coffee, maybe a little snack to take or something. And I take the basic text, or I had another book that had the 11th step in it. And I would go out to this place. It was in the woods. It was this lake in the woods and the dam that, you know, helped create the lake. And one side was the lake. You know, behind me would be the lake. In front of me is this big expanse of marsh. You know, because I'm down in Tidewater, Virginia's tidal marshes. And couldn't see any houses. It was all woods and just nature stuff. And I'd sit there and I'd read the 11th step. Now, I haven't got to the 4th step with my sponsor yet, but I'd read that because this God thing was doing something. And I'd read the 11th, you know, read a little bit, and I'd sit there and, you know, ponder what I was reading, maybe sip some coffee or whatever. And invariably, you know how like on a big wheat field or something, you can see the wind start on the far side of the field and make its way across? Invariably, it would start moving the marsh grass way over there, and it would get to me, and it would whisper through my ears. And it would be like, "She just moved. Is she getting ready to tell me 5 minutes?" And it was like my higher power. It was like God talking to me. I said, "Yeah, I got you. I'm here." I didn't trust myself in a car. I try to pass this on these days. When you're new, do not take yourself to frickin' meetings. You're in a car, you got way too much mobility. That's where, they used to, Louie L. and them used to joke about how Neil would come down London Boulevard and to a street called Effingham Street. To the left was a treatment center where New Beginnings and Freebird were both meeting in the cafeteria Monday and Thursday. To the right was not recovery. It was a different neighborhood, and my car just instinctively, you know, I had to fight the steering wheel to get it to go to the left. And so I didn't drive. I got, you know, addicts to come get me, which meant I had to call somebody. which means I had to let somebody get to know me. And so, like I said, I grew up on a farm. I had about quarter mile long dirt lane to go down. And so I walked down the lane. This one, Kenny H., would pick me up a lot. He's passed away now. And he had a nice Camaro or Firebird or something at the time. So I didn't want to drive the car down this muddy country road. And so I walked down there to meet him at the end of the lane. And I'd be talking to my higher power. I made it through a day. I'm getting through the pain. And there was this one stretch of the lane that went underneath these tall pine trees. And invariably, as I'd walk underneath those pine trees, the wind would whisper through the trees. Maybe it's just the wind whispering through the trees. It wasn't for this attic. I knew I was not walking alone. Not walking alone. So, wait, Chris, where are you going? I haven't got to the good part yet. Love you, bud. All right, that's a good segue. Let's stop for just a second. Let's do something different. Y'all put up with Kermit singing. That slipped out. I'm sorry. That was a mistake. Let's do something for a second. We talk about this being a we program. So, close your eyes, and let's take some breaths. Breathe in slowly. Maybe as you breathe in, say to yourself, trust. On the exhale, God. Trust. God. Two more. Trust. God. One more. Trust. God. All right. Now, put your hands in your lap, palms up. And we're going to do, I used to joke about not doing this in recovery. And I can tie this directly into recovery. It's not just Neil's meditation stuff. Put your hands in your laps, palms up, and we're going to go, Om. Trust me, we will do this 5 times. Take a deep breath in. Om. Deep breath in. Supposed to be doing this. Om. Deep breath. Om. Two more. Start with that. Reason why I wanted to do that, like I said, we talk about this as a we program, and we think it's we, us here, but like when we were doing the breathing, every living thing around us is breathing. The grass is breathing, those trees are breathing. So it's not just we, us people, it's we, this universe. And the Om, it's a vibration, everything is vibrating. The chimneys, they look solid, they're vibrating. We are all connected. There is a higher power that's trying to connect all of us. And the only thing that stands in the way, at least in my case, is me. The purpose of these steps, actually a lot of people think the purpose of these steps is to get clean. It's not. It's a byproduct. The purpose of the steps is to help us develop a personal working relationship with a loving, caring, higher power. That relationship will change my personality. that changed personality will be free from the bondage of active addiction. And so the process of these steps is to helping me separate all the separateness that separates me from the just the love abounding universe and fellowship. So I started working this process, like I was saying. I got, after a little while, I started feeling kind of funky. And my sponsor, Jimmy C. Ted might know. I don't know if you know him. Jim Creel, he's passed away now. He was my sponsor, and I told him, all of a sudden I kind of feel funny. I feel unsettled. He said, well, maybe it's time to work your first four step. And so I was leery about doing it because I was living back at my parents' house. How old was I then? 26. I ended up moving back at 40. But anyway, we'll get to that. And I was leery of writing a four step, you know, keeping it in my sock drawer or whatever, because I remember back in my high school days, I'd come home, I found this in your sock drawer. She's holding up my bag of weed. So I did not want to come home from a meeting. I found this in your sock drawer and hold up my four step. And so I prayed about it. And my sister, whose house I broke into a bunch of times, they were going out of town, wanted me to house sit. And I was like, well, holy crap, there's my privacy to do my first four step. Did the first four step, went over it with my sponsor in the fifth step. Back then, there was no flat book back then, thank God. Wait, did I say that? That slipped out. And we did six and seven right there. And in seven, you know, I'm an addict. So I want instant gratification. So remove these defects and let me be a saint. You know, like Samantha on Bewitched. Most of y'all are too young to know Samantha. And that's not how it's worked for me. It's a work in progress. I can't remove my defects of character. My higher power works through that. And worked on through the steps, 8 and 9, you know, made amends where necessary and learned 10, 11, and 12, live on those. And I really got into this thing. And the connection to my higher power, it was just moments sublime. Early in recovery, I told you about the stuff walking down the lane and hearing the wind in my ears and stuff. And you hear this a lot. You know, I need to go make amends to the dope man because I owed him money. It's not a good idea. I think you can work some of these steps before we get to one with the sponsor. 8 and 9, no. You need to get to those with your sponsor. At least I did. But I went and go make amends to the dope man tell him, no, don't ever give me anything anymore. But I got a little something before I did say that. It was some powder. All I had to put in was a dollar bill and threw it in the crease of the bill, folded up, put it in my pocket. And then the battle started. You know, oh, no, don't. I'm driving one of my dad's trucks and it's lunchtime. We ate lunch at my parents' house. The company did. And, you know, the battle, oh, no, yeah, well, no, yeah, well, it's only, I don't know how much I had. Well, you only got, this will be the last time. You've already started the process. This will be the last time. And I went to go find some paraphernalia I needed to do what I needed to do and couldn't find anything. So then I'm like, I'm an engineer. I engineer shit out of stuff. I'm like, okay, that's God telling me that if I can't find, I'll just say it. If I can't find a set of works by the time I get off work, that's God telling me don't do this. like God's going to really work that way. But the battle's still going on. I pull up to a stop line in a truck, and here's how old this, long ago this was. I had to roll the window down. Once again, if you're listening to this, I'm making a cranking motion with my left hand. And I unfold the bill, looking at it, a little pile of powder, and unfold it. And finally, I got just to the window. And whoosh, it was empty. I mean, it didn't some of it swirl around, some of it just, it was clean. I could have eaten off the dollar bill. It happened so fast, I did a double take, like, holy crap. And then I laughed, because it's like my higher power had been sitting on the back of the truck. Give me a chance. And that's how it works. I've got to give y'all a chance. I gave him half a chance, and bam! I put dollar bill away, and I knew I was safe for that day. And so life got amazing. And I'm speeding up real quick here. And I had some job opportunities. I got into the treatment field like a lot of people are doing now with the, what is it, CBS, PRC, NBC, what's the thing? Peer, that thing. Back then, you were a counselor assistant. And I saw some of the people these places were hiring. I was like, holy shit, anybody can work there. I'm still working on judgmental. And I went to work at a treatment center, and I found out, you know, when you do something, you just feel like you're good at it. I was good at it. I liked it. And then I had another job opportunity with my brother to go work. Him and his two partners started a company doing big video screen projection on, like, for concerts and stuff. And they needed help, so I went to work for them. And I found myself working for the Rolling Stones. And spent the fall and winter of 89, this is the Steel Wheels Tour, all over North America, and going to meetings, clean. Then we did Europe, summer of 1990. And while we're on the Steel Wheels Tour, we got a contract to do a video for the Grateful Dead. All right, my first album that I ever bought was Sticky Fingers, Rolling Stones. At 14, I'm listening to Please, Sister Morphine. My mom should have been worried. and I find myself clean, a sniveling cheap. I didn't move kilos of this. I'd go out boosting all day. There was a Bojangles chicken place across the street from where everybody was copping at the time. If I had enough money to cop and buy a 99-cent wing special, that was two wings and a biscuit, that was a good day. Because I copped and I ate two chicken wings. And that's how, and I'm thinking, I'm just this petty junkie from Portsmouth, and I'm working for the Rolling Stones. Holy shit. We did the show in Rome, and they're carrying the crew to the hotel, and we passed the street, and it was Via Appian, the Appian Way. I was like, the Appian Way, holy shit. I didn't really know what the Appian, but I've heard that in literature and shit. And we got to this, just an amazing hotel with all lit up and like a big villa. And everybody goes to check in. The crew all goes down to the hotel bar, and they're all hanging out, and I meet them down there and have a club soda for a second. And I'm thinking, shit, I can go to a bar in Portsmouth. And I went out back, and there was this formal garden, and I'm wandering around this garden at nighttime, and it's, you know, dry summer heat. It's just nice. And I sat down on a bench, and I'm overlooking the city of Rome. And I'm like, I was told when I got here, you can find a way of life beyond your wildest dreams. You might not end up working for the Rolling Stones because they really need to retire. But I guarantee you, I disagree with it. The only promise is freedom from active addiction. Our steps don't even say that. Our steps say having had a spiritual awakening. I guarantee you still, you can find a way. You cannot even comprehend how different your life can be if you're coming in here new. And so then, like I said, we worked for the Grateful Dead, and that was Moment Sublime there. So it was great, amazing stuff, that new job, this amazing stuff with touring. But then I also had, you know, my best friend OD'd and died. It was several days before anybody found him. You know, I had family members pass away. I had a lot of shit happen in about a five-year span. And I started feeling like I wasn't having time to process it. In about 10 years, I started feeling like I was crazy, going crazy. Went through the steps again. And 20. And tried to get some help with it and everything. And then I decided I'd had a lot of fun being single and clean. And I decided, you know, I need a relationship. And I met a girl who both grew up in the same church, and she drank a bit. She drank a lot. And but we met in church, so it's a God thing. And so everybody in my support group, this is kind of important. By this time I had 12 and a half years clean. And I was one of the old timers. And everybody in my support group, everybody in my church said, well, aren't y'all's lifestyles kind of different? Oh, no, it's a God thing. And I totally ignored everybody's input and made a huge life decision based totally on self-will, and I didn't make it out of it clean. I put myself in a situation where she was drinking. We lived in a neighborhood with a lot of party crowd. And I found myself thinking, maybe you're not an addict. Maybe you started when you were 13. That was way too immature. You're 40 now, much more mature. I'm an engineer, so I'm engineering this shit. And maybe you're just not. And I saw people drinking with apparent impunity in the neighborhood, and I'm thinking, oh, but here's the key. I said, I wish I could get drunk. I never said I wish I could have a beer. I went right to, I wish I could get drunk. And then I had back surgery, and so I had to take pain meds. And I told the doctor, hey, I'm a recovering addict, history of opioid abuse, blah, blah, blah. There was this new medication at the time called Tramadol. Supposed to be safer. You know, it's made to be a safe alternative. I took that, and it triggered craving. And I started abusing it. I got to get to this. I started abusing that, but I could rationalize it because I just had back surgery. And then that ran out, and some neighbors had this, that, or the other, and, well, still have a lot of pain from the back surgery. Can y'all? And then I drank. I didn't really drink. I had a cold, and I took a hot toddy. Well, I took 10 hots because I bought a 10-pack of Wild Turkey. And because it might be a bad cold. And I could rationalize all that. I did not want to look at what was going on. Then one night, this is critical. I went to a party in the neighborhood. My wife had already gone out, gone back home, passed out drunk. And somebody passed around some weed. And I smoked some. And I went home. Now keep in mind, this connection with a God has touched my heart, moved my heart. Went home, the house was silent, sat down on the couch, and I realized I could not justify the weed, could not rationalize it. I said, Neil, you're using. And that God was instantly a million miles away. And she hadn't moved. I'm the one that moved. It was the loneliest feeling I have ever known. So then I started using hard just not to feel how bad I felt. I'll say this real quick and I'll shut up maybe. And so I'm an engineer. So I got this craving in my head. And I think I need to blast this craving, go back, pick up a white chip and get started. So what you can do, I don't like to talk about specific substances, but here it kind of fits in. You can do a shot of something, and it'll blast that out. Y'all can figure out what it is. It'll blast that craving out, and you'll be okay. No, my veins, I don't have any veins. And, well, they say that crack stuff is just like, you know, and, well, that's what I'll do. I'll go get some of that, and I'll just take a big old hit of that. It'll blast the craving out of my head. I'll pick up a white chip, and I'll be good to go. And 2.5 years later, I'm like, this isn't working real well. I was a nuclear engineer at the shipyard in Portsmouth, and the Navy is really funny about you smoking crack around their reactors. And anyway, real quick, I can laugh, but it was horrible, horrible darkness. The using wasn't that much worse, but the emotional shit was terrible. And I knew I had gotten clean on January 10th, 1985, because it was a moment of grace. And I was afraid that moment of grace was going to come, and I'd be so wrapped up in the insanity, I would miss it. Christmas Eve, went to church service with my daughter, already had a little something in the car, already done a little something, took her, rushed her back home after church to her mom's house, went in the neighborhood, got a little something, came back out. Just after midnight, Christmas Eve, so it was Christmas Day, I turned into the neighborhood, and I heard a voice say, you can turn around if you want. And I turned around. And as soon as I turned around, I knew I was safe. And not in some cocky, arrogant way. I knew I had turned back to you guys. Y'all never shamed me. Y'all welcomed me with open arms. The only shame was I felt myself, and I still struggle with that. When I put the clean date, my clean time down, December 25th, 1999, I want to put a little disclaimer. Well, really, it's supposed to be 85. That's ego shit. So we do need to kind of, everybody needs to get out of here. So I will just say this. If you're new, please stick with us. There was a couple back there that stood up with 5 days clean during the, they were sitting right over there. With 23 years under my belt now, I still know what it's like to be counting days. If you're counting days, you are a fucking warrior. A fucking warrior. And you don't have to fight by yourself. We will walk you through this shit. And you will find a way of life beyond your wildest dreams. So with that, I think I'll shut up. Thank you.